Today is Thursday. It's December. Today.
It's September 6th, John.
Today is Thursday. It is September 6th, 2018. It's 11:14 in the morning. This is John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio, judged the best podcast in Chicago from the Headline Club. By the way, you can hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 on WGN Radio and Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12
That's
noon.
That's going to bring him over now.
I'm Scott Standis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune, creator of the comic strip Prickly City and host of the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN Plus.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN and the news anchor for John Williams Show.
I'm Eric Zorn, the impetuous, adversarial, petty, and ineffective columnist for the Tribune. I run three times a week, and you can find me.
We will go to Trump land in the second half of this podcast, where the horse is loose in the hospital. But before we do that, as predicted here on the Mincing Rascals last week, Rahm Emanuel will not seek a third term.
Did we predict that?
I think I did, didn't I?
We said the exact opposite, that we'd fall over dead if that happens, and it did. He says he wants to spend more time with his family. So I have questions for you guys. Do you believe that? How strange is it that someone with a $10 million war chest for a local office suddenly bows out, and who will the next mayor be? Eric, you go first.
I believe that spending time with his family looked much more appealing to him than the bruising battle that he was going to face politically in the first election, and then the runoff election that I think he was going to be able to make. And then it looked more appealing to him than having to manage this city through all the problems that it's having, some of them seemingly very intractable. So I think that when he sort of looked at the next 4 years and he just thought, you know what, I don't have the heart for this, I don't have the stomach for this, I don't want to do it anymore.
Those are the same thing to me.
Yes.
I'd rather spend time with my family than do that.
Yes, I don't think he's going to be like, you know, like Michael Jordan, where he said, I want to spend time with my family, and then all of a sudden his family, he just, you know.
Well, I give him great credit. He didn't really say he wanted to spend time with his family, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Doesn't he say people say that? That's part of his comments. People always say that.
And then he said, of course, my family already left the house.
Right.
That's true. They are empty nesters. But I think
it was kind of a nod to how empty that statement usually is.
Oh, yeah, but I hate that statement. What is your take on it then? Why did he do it?
I think what Eric said, he probably looked at it and his kids are gone and it's time to spend some time with his wife maybe.
Oh,
but
come on. I'm sorry. No, this guys like him don't do that. There's something at play here. There's got to be. Yes, he kicked the can down the road on debt and lobbed billions of dollars on the city. That payment's going to blow up. The pension payment is going to balloon and blow up. But, I mean, you can't say you're going to spend time with your family when there's no family to spend time with.
Look, just because the kids are in college now, you could take a road trip with your wife and go see them at one of their schools, and you can have a leisurely weekend. You could walk in the beach hand in hand with your spouse. You can just have the life that you've never had. He said, I told my wife when we got engaged that I would never run for office, and then I did it six times, or something like that.
I'm not saying he's done. He's never going to work or do anything again.
He's
but
not going to run for office again.
No, I don't think so either.
Scott is alluding to the possibility that there's...
Of course he's going to run again.
No.
For what? What's he going to run for? Okay. Right here on WGN, this wonderful historic radio station, yesterday morning on Wednesday, he mentioned that the person who's going to win is not in the race yet.
Their candidate or mayoral candidates is not... The list is not done. It's going to shake out for about a month. And then the voters will make a smart decision of who can fill that office.
Which tells me there are plates on sticks in the air right now, twirling and twirling and twirling, that we don't see.
What's that got to do
with
him?
So what does that mean?
That he's part of that alchemy, that there's a quid pro quo here. I will bet you all the money in my pocket.
But what is it? I mean, give me a scenario.
Possible scenario that's being floated is that, you know, he is stepping down. The anointed one will step up, have $10 million in their war chest like that.
He can hand it to them.
After Pritzker gets elected, Durbin retires for whatever reason, steps down, and Pritzker appoints Rahm Emanuel as the next senator from the great state of Illinois, which positions him to be on the national ticket.
Okay. This sounds like a Ward Just novel.
Oh, but I thought
we were going to wait to go to Crazy Town. Because this stuff never happened in Illinois. It could have, but he's really is well enough positioned to be appointed senator from the mayor's office as well.
I mean, there's nothing about being mayor prohibits you from being appointed senator. I'd like to talk a little bit about who we think the presumptive winner of this election is going to be. Who do we like now that the field's been cleared? I thought Emanuel was going to win. I wrote this week, I said, you know, yeah, his poll numbers were tough, but I think that he still was, the stars were aligning for him to win.
The incumbency factor is huge.
Well, he has a lot of money. He's a tough campaigner,
Eric,
a very smart campaigner.
But seriously, why is anybody interested in the notion that there's something else afoot here, that there's some...
Well, Scott is clearly interested in that notion.
But, I mean, that's politics. I've heard people say, no, there's something in a closet we don't know about that's going to come
like
up.
You mean like a Juan McDonald cover-up
like
sort of thing?
Like a disease or something like that? What are you talking about?
I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about.
A secret videotape?
Okay, there is no such thing. Never mind that.
No, I mean, there might be.
Russians have a tape.
Yeah,
our
right.
record for forecasting is pretty poor, given what we said last week. So I see it as sort of a normal thing to have happen.
Who's your pick?
Right now, I would have to say, of all people, I would have to say Vallis jumps into the front runner spot. I know the flash poll showed McCarthy out in front, but I think that that's a little bit of name recognition. I think that Vallis has the resume. He's not my personal pick necessarily, but I think that you'd have to give him the edge. But that doesn't count. I mean, if Toni Preckwinkle gets into this race, I know she's, 72 years old, and she has the pop tax to deal with, but she's a formidable person.
What do you guys think of the mayor saying that the next mayor has not been yet announced?
That's the question, right?
That's yeah. Right. Who are the people who you would say? Who are the, you know, give me the top three who you think right now are the ones who are...
Lightfoot, McCarthy, and Vallis.
Really?
You're surprised by that list?
No. Of the announced candidates, right. I would say definitely. I would say you're right about that.
Right. So, I mean, think of all of the people that are running. I think some of us are running. So that for the mayor to say that of that field of a dozen, none of them are going to be the next mayor is hubris. That's just him bragging.
Oh, I don't agree with that at all. I think he's probably right.
Who has greater name recognition?
That's what we're talking about.
Arnie Duncan's name has been floated, right?
Then why hasn't Arnie Duncan announced?
They weren't going to run against Mayor Emanuel. What does that say about their interest in the job then
if they're not going to run because it might be competitive?
Well, it says they want to win.
I think Gutierrez is an excellent guess, if you will, because look where Rahm came from. He came from the Congress. He has high name recognition. And whoever comes in and is the anointed one from Emanuel, you mentioned it earlier, he comes in with, she comes in with $10 million like that.
Do you guys think that will happen?
Emanuel said he's going to return most of the money that was given to him.
Yeah, to who? To the people who gave it to him.
Because you look in your ledger book and go, well, it was $5.
I gave $50. Here's $26 from the Girl Scouts.
Yeah. I don't think you do that. Another name that's been mentioned is Mike Quigley, my congressman up there in the 5th District. Mike is a sort of a centrist to progressive Democrat.
What about Pilar?
I like him personally. I think he's a good guy. I don't think he has the organizational ability or the structure in place to mount a serious campaign for mayor.
Does Congressman Quigley have the base and the... He seems like he'd be a good candidate who would need some running time. I don't know if he could...
Yeah. I think you're right. I think that he would have a tougher time ramping up, getting the support of the business community, getting the big donors coming behind him. I would guess that would be Preckwinkle. I mean, the thing is that Preckwinkle has some strikes against her. One is like she's 72, and this job is really, really hard. I don't mean to be ageist, but it's a really tough
72
job.
Is the new 62, though.
Oh, sure, let's go with that.
Okay. what about
Bill? Now here's one. What about Bill Daley?
See, I think the Daley name.
Yeah, I saw that.
I think the Daley name is just done in Chicago. I think we've had enough Daleys.
Who are you thinking, Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, Bill Daley he's sort of swooped in a few times before, and it's never quite worked out very well. I don't see him running for governor at one point.
I hate this whole dynasty thing anyway. Okay, but before we go to Van Dyke, and we are about to, Steve Bertram, was Rahm a good mayor?
I think we'll look back on him as being a good mayor. I do.
How about you, Eric?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, on balance, yes. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of things you can second guess. I've second guessed him on some things, but I think you have to look at the mess that he was left. And this is something he doesn't like to talk about that much, or he hasn't, of what a mess Daley left him by selling off all the parking meter revenue, for kicking all those cans down the road. And he has gotten the city back sort of on financial footing. Now, we have had the benefit of a pretty long recovery, but there are construction cranes all over this town, and not enough in the neighborhoods, yeah. Clearly. But I think on balance, yes. Scott?
No. I think he's been a poor mayor.
Will he be a good senator? Do you think he'll be a good senator?
Yeah, because he'll only be one of 100, so you can only do so much damage, though. No, you look at the violence in the city, that's ticking up pretty significantly. You look at the debt, and that's a massive issue. And it's not, he's not going to have to pay the price for this. The next person is.
Daley saddled him with these incredibly long union contracts, incredibly long, generous union contracts that Daley wanted for the 2016 Olympics. Remember the 2016 Olympics here in Chicago?
I know.
That's what
they, God, they were great.
Oh, really? Is that what that was predicated on?
Yeah, that's why we have all those really, really long union contracts. And violence, you're right. It's in the Laquan McDonald story, which we're going to talk about in a second. Yeah. But again, I think his fiscal stewardship has not been as irresponsible as you made it out to be. I mean, I don't think things got worse under him, is what I'm saying.
I spend a lot of time talking about the tech world on the Business Lunch, and you know, he's been a real friend to the tech sector in the city, really growing that. And that's one concern to me, to see who comes next and whether that will continue to be fostered, because I think that's the future in so many ways.
The Jason Van Dyke jury is being seated this week and next, and maybe the week after that. The Chicago police officer is charged with 6 murder counts, 16 counts of aggravated battery, and the shooting death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. This was in 2014, so now almost 4 full years later, potential jurors are walking through a line of protesters. Should the case be tried outside of Cook County? And would you guys go with a judge or this judge or a jury on this?
Just one thing while we're sitting here. The judge just ruled to increase his bail by $2,000 because he gave the interview to the rascals sitting across from us, the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, no kidding. $2,000?
That's like $200 bond,
that'll
right?
Teach him.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
It doesn't matter, right? The damage, whatever that may have created, is done, and we're going to have this trial. But the judge said, I don't like that. Would you go with this judge or would you go with the jury?
Typically, defense attorneys for police officers like to go with judges. They think they feel like they get a better shake on this. In this case, what you're looking for is one juror. And I don't exactly know how they're going to present this evidence and what they're going to be allowed to show and so on. But a jury seems like it might be the way to go, because all you need is one person to hang the jury to say, you know what? I'd have done it, too. I'd have shot that kid, too. And that's all you need is one person.
What do you think, so, Scott?
Yeah, I thought their change of venue request was legitimate, and they probably should have. Now, it's obviously late.
No, it's not. I don't think it is. I think he's going to be ruling on that.
They could do that, and until the 12th juror is seated, they can actually decide to go with a bench trial.
But why? What's the point of seating a jury if you're going to maybe move it?
Well, I mean, you may want to see who is going to be seated, and you may get a sense from your jury consultants, and I'm sure they have them. When you look at the jury, you look at the makeup of the jury pool, you say, you know what, we're never going to get an acquittal out of this jury, so let's move it.
I was intrigued this week by the fact that the defense presented, conducted a survey and found that 51% of the people that have seen the video absolutely believe that Van Dyke is guilty of murder. 51% have already made up their mind that he's guilty. I don't know what their spin on that is. Is that, look, see how difficult it is for us, but I think that shows the glass is half full. If after seeing that, half of you still think that he may not be guilty of murder, then I'm encouraged by that if I'm Jason Van Dyke.
They're going to take that video and they're going to advance it and frame by frame, millisecond by millisecond, to show you what happened. And it's not going to be just, you know, just watch this video and watch what happens, watch him shot down like a dog. They're going to pull it apart frame by frame and say, what is he doing? What is Officer Van Dyke doing? And is he justified in doing this? This is what they're going to do. And I think at that point, you may have people changing their minds. I don't know.
Why?
But
changing their mind from where to where?
Why? From saying that it was understandable or justified?
It was never understandable. No, anybody that sees that is going to say he was a full lane of traffic away, walking away. He pulled up and shot him 16 times.
Yeah.
Chatter on the radio corroborates exactly that scene, which is the cops had it under control. They were de-escalating. This kid was either drunk or stoned or both, whatever. The cop's voice on the radio is
what could
very
have justified
calm.
What could have justified?
I don't think it's justifiable. But you know, at one point he's got a knife in his right hand and he's swinging it. It's not swinging it at the officers, as they said later in their reports, but he's swinging it and they're saying, so he's got a knife in his hand and he's walking away. That what he's going to say, I think, is they're going to say, well, we were worried that he was going to go and attack somebody else.
Sure.
It does work. If the guy's got a gun and he's going and he's
got 8 squad cars around this guy with 16 guns pointing at him, and you've got a drunk kid
John,
walking
I'm
down
your,
the street
I totally,
with a highway.
I don't see it either, but I'm saying this is what they're going to argue. And they're also going to muddy up Laquan McDonald in a way that I think is just absurd and obscene. There's the provision in Illinois law that allows you in a self-defense case, which Van Dyke is going to be asserting self-defense, almost certainly, that allows you to explore the character of the victim, the person who's dead, the dead person. But the reason that they allow that is because usually self-defense cases are, you know, we went into a room and I felt really threatened by this person, so I shot him. So you're allowed to say, well, we look at his character and it makes it more likely that he's the person who attacked. But now we have videotape that shows that. I don't see the relevance of that. But that's going to be part of this case, too.
Don't you think there's a huge flaw with that line of logic, Steve?
With self-defense?
Yeah. I mean, that I knew the character of the individual. He didn't know the character.
Whether you knew it or not, the character of the individual informs the fact finder's opinion as to what might have happened. So he said, well, if these guys had gone like behind a wall, and then Van Dyke had said he advanced on me, and you can say, well, let's look at his history, and we'll see that he had some violence in his past.
But if the person acting in self defense is absolutely unaware of that person's history, are you in a way you're crediting intuition or something?
What I'm saying is that this evidence is allowed when a jury is trying to decide which version of events is more likely. I'm saying, let's say they went behind a wall, and we don't have the video. And Van Dyke says, as he said before, well, he advanced on me. He was going to kill me. So they look at his character and they say, well, he's the kind of guy who would have done that. Now, the reason I don't think that's applicable and why I think it's absurd to do this in this case is that we have the video that shows us what happened. We don't need evidence of Laquan McDonald's past character.
Your explanations keep saying when we go behind a wall, there's no wall.
There is no wall. There's video here, but as far as I can tell right now, Judge Gaughan is going to allow this kind of evidence in there. And I think the purpose of it is not to try to establish that Laquan McDonald was being aggressive to the police officer. He clearly wasn't. It's to make the jury think that our city is better off without this kid, that this kid being dead is overall a good thing. And that's what the defense attorneys are going to try to plant in the jury's minds, Jason Van Dyke went out that night, and yeah, he shot this kid, but we're better off because of it. And I think that that's what the defense is going
to
be doing.
I don't have anything
to
say about that, but I do feel bad for Officer Van Dyke.
Well, that's a terrible thing for them to be arguing, and they shouldn't be allowed to argue, but that's what I think they're doing.
I feel bad for Officer Van Dyke. I feel bad for officers who, unless they are everyday corrupt, unless they're just demonstrably bad people who should go to jail. Van Dyke was not that person, and he made a huge mistake in 5 seconds time, and now his life is over. Because I think he has to go to jail for a very long time. And it's such a shame that officers are put in a position where they have to make those life and death decisions, not only for the victim of his shooting, but for his own life. Well, now it's over.
I said this last week, I'll say it again. I think that it's a shame that he killed Officer Van Dyke killed Laquan McDonald, but it's a scandal what happened afterwards. All the brass, they all got together, they saw that video. They, you know, the police on the scene made up stories to vindicate Van Dyke.
Well, they're good. They may go to jail too. I mean, there's three more cases.
There's three of them that have been charged in that case. But there's a whole bunch of them. The inspector general urged 11. Found 11 members of officers and up in the brass culpable in this.
Gosh, and for some reason, Rahm didn't want to be mayor anymore. I don't understand
it. Well, he did suppress the video for 6 months.
Well,
but I mean, he was a good mayor.
When we do write this book, though, you've got Mayor Emanuel's tenure ending, probably not completely coincidentally by this. You got Anita Alvarez. I mean, this case will resent a fundamental change one way or another here.
As residents of Crazy Town,
it's like there's a horse loose in a hospital. I think everything's going to be okay, but I have no idea what's going to happen next. And, like, none of you know either. Like, we've all never not known together.
Where the horse is loose in the hospital, the New York Times has published an anonymous op-ed from a senior administration official who may or may not be Mike Pence. The essay says many people in the administration are working to frustrate the president's plans. Quote, the root of the problem is the president's amorality. This person is unmoored, said the anonymous senior administration official, referring to the president, of course. He veers off topic and is reckless in decision-making. America should know, he wrote, or this person wrote, it may be a female, that there are adults in the room. It closes saying, we have sunk to a new low with him. Is this writer a real person? Is it Mike Pence? Is it treason? And should the person come forth, Steve?
It is a real person. It is not Mike Pence. It is certainly not treason. And it would be nice if this person and others who agreed with him or her came forward.
How about you, Eric?
I basically agree with Steve. I don't think it's necessary for this person to come forward. I'm not sure that we really learned anything from this op-ed, this anonymous op-ed, that we didn't already know, except that there seems to be... I mean, the thing is, Bob Woodward's book came out, a couple of days before this anonymous op-ed, and it told us pretty much the same thing, which was that there are people in the White House who are actively working to suppress this man's
But it's more direct
impulses.
If you have an account directly from one of those people.
Right, it is.
Some people don't want to believe Woodward. This is one of those quote-unquote sources saying, right. Yeah, it's us, and they're adults. So we know it's crazy. We're doing everything we can to keep him from doing damage.
I am absolutely certain that this is a real person and that the New York Times vetted that person and spoke to that person and knows who that person is.
I wonder what a senior administration official means. Is it really a senior administration official? What is that? How close is this person? How legitimate are they? Are they really a Republican? I wish they'd come out and tell us that, and their career in an administration that they don't love anyway, and do everybody a favor by making this process more transparent.
Right. And we were talking at an editorial board meeting this morning at the Tribune and asking the woman who is our op-ed editor whether or not she's ever, in the 25 years she's held that position, run an anonymous piece, and she goes, never. We were around the table asking, and people ask that all the time for letters to the editors. I get it for my caption contest. Can I use a non-diploma? No, you can't. Eric, I mean, as a fellow newspaper guy, I look at this and I kind of shake my head and go, how did they allow this to happen? Why were you the one who suggested perhaps they should have just put a reporter on it?
I wasn't the one who suggested that, but I don't see a huge difference between interviewing an anonymous source and publishing what that anonymous source says and allowing an anonymous person to write something. I mean, you could say at the top.
Well, it's
of
much
the piece,
more compelling at the in the top, first person.
It's a much more compelling thing in the first person, and I think it is newsworthy. I think that when you have, as a matter of general principle, as a matter of course, no, do you run anonymous op-eds all the time, letting people settle scores? This seemed like a highly newsworthy event here, having this person inside the White House saying this. I mean, it's a very important thing to have happen. I think you make an exception for the general rule for some.
So we keep using the word anonymous, and it's anonymous. I guess I don't know if it's a verb to us, but it's not to the New York Times. Right. And so I think the only leap of faith we need here is that the New York Times knows who this person is. And when they say it's a senior administration official, we trust their judgment on that.
It's very weird. We ask who that official is, what level they might be at. I think I heard on TV this morning, it's like it could be up to like 250 people would actually fall under that rubric of senior administration official because there's so many of them in various departments and so on. The presumption is that this person works closely with the cabinet, works even in the White House.
But the people who think it's Pence, this is because of a friend of mine said he used the term lodestar.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So if you're Mike Pence and you're writing this letter, right? As I said, if I was in third grade and didn't want the girl across the aisle from the desk, I would write it left-handed cursive. You know, you wouldn't use any of your typical language. You wouldn't use a word like lodestar. Maybe the person who wrote this wants us to think it's Mike Pence.
It's really well written.
Yes,
it has prose. I get it. So that's
like, I'll throw him off the trail. Use the word lodestar.
Yeah, right. So Pence is going, oh, crap.
That's
I
my
love
word.
The word lodestar.
That's not a word.
Damn it.
I can't say
Mommy
that the rest
I
of my
it all
life.
The time.
Yeah. Boy, that's, I love that level of intrigue, but it's interesting because that thing was so well written. It has a certain style. It has a vocabulary. You'd think that if any, I'll bet if the four of us wrote something, the other three would be able to guess who wrote it based on our knowledge
of that
person.
But if we wrote it for this reason, if you're a decent writer, you can undo your own writing.
Right, well, write it in.
Who remembers the book? Was it called Primary Colors?
Yeah.
It was written by Anonymous.
Yeah.
And there were some forensic grammarians who went through and figured out that it was Joe Klein, who then fessed up that it was him.
Yeah.
So you can, your writing style is, there's some fingerprints that you leave on it that are hard to erase. But someone who's very skilled at this or might have just had run it through the word processor a few times, changed a few of his
signature. Well, let me ask
signature.
Scott, how long before we know the identity of the writer?
Oh, it's going to be, I'd say, a week to 10 days. Wouldn't you go? I'd be shocked if it goes that long.
I don't know.
But you asked the question, was it treason? No, it's not treason. The president, hell, he doesn't know. He has never read the Constitution, let alone define it. But yes, the person should come forward because the constitutional question this does raise is, should we now seriously look at using the 25th Amendment, which is, that's if the president goes cuckoo, you can remove him or her for a time And I think that that's what this raises.
I thought that was amazing that this anonymous person suggested that at one point they had thought about that, but they didn't want to create a constitutional crisis.
Well, not just they.
They
talked about members of cabinet talked about it. It was a bigger circle than just the
writer. It's funny that he calls that a constitutional crisis. It would be a constitutional awkwardness, but that's a remedy. That's the Constitution talking.
Exactly.
That's what you're supposed to do. The problem with the 25th Amendment is it's impossible. It's impossible to use. It's not like a few of us go, yeah, he's wacko, he's out.
Well, it's not supposed to be easy to remove a president.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just not.
It's more for situations like Woodrow Wilson, right, where someone is extremely ill and unable to function in the office. Now, we can trash Donald Trump day and night, but the thing is that he is functioning as president. He's not like running around naked around the White House or anything like that outside. And I mean, so you have to, yeah, you can't say, well, this guy's like, he's like a horse in a hospital. Let's get rid of him. You can't do that. I mean, it's like I say, as much as I would like to invoke it in a special clause right now, no, you can't do that because, you know, you have to look at what the precedent would be. I don't think it's fair.
We're talking about constitutional crises. You know, I want to look at it from the other side because we can say, well, this is great. He wanted Assad assassinated and the defense secretary said no, or the generals refused to do it. Now, we have a civilian leadership for the military, and the civilian leader, the commander-in-chief's commands are supposed to be followed. So just because we think it's a good idea that they don't kill Assad doesn't mean that there's not a little constitutional hinkiness there, too.
Wait a minute. I mean, so if Trump says, I want that done, and he is our elected military leader,
he's the commander-in-chief,
that's what's supposed
and then
to
if
happen.
Generals don't
and
do
it.
Do
you think the same then if he wanted to nuke North Korea next week?
I'm just saying that, you know, just because the generals are doing what we want to do and not what Trump wants them to do, there's still a problem there.
That is exactly Steve brings up an excellent point, because if all of this is true, what Anonymous wrote in the New York Times is true, this is also comes precariously close to a coup d'etat.
Yeah, it does.
And that is a bad thing, for those of you who don't know.
I don't even know that it is. I
mean, for those of you who don't know, it is.
Why is that a bad thing?
Because it's usurping the authority of a duly elected official, and in our form of government, that duly elected official is the authority.
We can't stand behind the Constitution once in a while.
Okay, hear me out. You guys may persuade me otherwise. But then would not our founding fathers have said, well, it would be inappropriate for us to break with England because we're citizens, we're subjects of the British Empire. So of course we have to play by their rules. I mean, maybe a little revolution. I'm a Thomas Jefferson guy. Maybe a little revolution is warranted once in a while.
Okay, well, another word for revolution is coup d'etat.
I'm arguing for it in this case.
But a coup d'etat sort of implies a much broader usurpation of power than what we're talking about here. We're talking about, like, letters being taken off Trump's desk.
This is more like the movie Dave.
Right. Okay, now this is the fourth topic. So on the heels of all of this, and maybe it's not a coincidence, this new Woodward book, Fear, comes out that describes the White House in such chaos. And it's nice because at least none of us have read it yet, right?
I don't think it's... Is it out yet?
Yeah, was it Tuesday? Was it this Tuesday or next Tuesday?
The published date is one of those.
Right.
But a few of the copies have gotten to places like the Washington Post. And they evidently, Weird. The book details some of the nutty intricacies of a Donald Trump White House, that some of his staffers will remove documents or hide them from him, fearing his actions on them, that the Secretary of Defense says he has the education or the sense of a fifth grader, stuff like that. What do we make of this book? And
was it in the book, too, that he's referring to Sessions as retarded and speaking with marbles in his mouth and ripping on Southerners?
Dumb Southerner.
I can tell you, as someone who worked in the South and has many Southern friends,
here it comes.
How offensive and how... But you know what?
Well, let's see.
There's still the Republican Party and the Republican and the Trumpanistas down in Alabama are keeping quiet on this one. And if a New Yorker had ever had said that about a Southerner any other time, they would be burning that guy in effigy.
At least he didn't wear a tan suit. I mean, that was
a big one, right?
What do you guys make, though, of the refutations by Mattis and Kelly and Sanders? Okay, whatever. But, I mean, categorically, those people are pointing to things as abject lies. They absolutely did not happen. I pay attention to that, and I don't know what to do with
Why
all
do you
of
pay
that.
Attention to that? This is Donald Trump's M.O. He
That's
denies
his
MO. Everything.
No, but this is Mike Mattis said that, and John Kelly said stuff that...
What are they going to say? What are they going to say? Yes, I called him an idiot.
They don't have to say anything. They don't have to do his bidding. They don't have to say, okay, I'll release a letter saying that these things are not true.
Well, I'd like to go back and parse their statements. I haven't looked at them that carefully. I thought it was funny. Trump said yesterday, within an hour and a half, the first thing he said was something like, yeah, that statement from Mattis, I had no idea that was coming. It was so nice he put that out there. I couldn't believe it. This is my recollection. And then an hour and a half later said, yeah, you know, the book, Secretary Mattis came to me and said, I'd like to put out a statement. Should I do it? And I said, yeah. Well, you know, they can't both be true. Trump is lying about the denials.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of those. I don't want to believe that I've reconciled that the president is a liar, but I don't want to believe that everybody around him is going to lie to me for him. Does that sound super naive?
I know you don't want to believe that. I understand.
Okay, well, let me ask you guys. Do you all think that the infection is so great that everybody at the administration level will absolutely lie to you 100% out of convenience?
Look at Watergate. Look at the arc of Watergate. Senior officials until it was...
Fine. How about you, Steve? Are you on board?
What if Mattis is one of the... not the deep state, the clean slate, whatever they called it, and he thinks he needs to be there in order to protect us, then that's pretty easy to justify that statement.
Really?
Okay. I can't wait for all the books that they're going to be written after Trump is gone, because all these people are going to write books, and they're all going to tell us what it was really like in there, and they're going to say that they were lying for the exact reason that the anonymous person said that he's staying, which is there have to be adults there who are putting up the guardrails so we don't get ourselves into World War III.
Do you think that Marco Rubio should have punched Alex Jones in the nose? So Marco Rubio, they're having these Twitter hearings, right, in Congress?
Yeah, Dorsey and Sandberg were before the Senate. Was it judiciary? No, it would have been intelligence
committee.
And Rubio's out there talking to reporters about what needs to be done. And that guy, Alex Jones, is beside him. Did you see this?
He's sort of ranting
on and on and on.
Marco Rubio the snake. Little frat boy here.
All right, man. Yeah. Well, who are you? Who is this guy? I swear to God, I don't know
who you are, man.
You better
hope you can be platforming. Tens of millions of views.
InfoWars.
Bigger than Rush Limbaugh. He knows who InfoWars is. He's playing this joke over here.
I know, but I don't want to be... I don't know
you want me to get arrested?
I don't know who you are.
It's not just going to take my First
arrested,
Amendment.
Man.
It's not just enough to take my First Amendment. Oh, he'll beat me up. You're not going to silence me. You're not going to silence America.
Well, but there are people.
You are literally like a little gangster thug.
Interrupting.
And Rubio has no idea who he is, which is kind of funny. He keeps laughing because I don't know who you are.
And Jones keeps saying, oh, yes, you know who I am. Yeah,
InfoWars.com. And finally, Jones patronizingly taps him on the shoulder, and Rubio says, don't touch me again.
And he said, what are you going to do? Get somebody done? He goes, no, I'll take care of this.
You're going to get me arrested? No, I'm not going to have you arrested. I'll take care of it myself. I'm telling you nice the first time.
So what then happens, Steve, if Rubio just hauls back and punches him in the face?
Oh, I sent him half my life savings.
And InfoWars subscriptions would go through the roof.
But I would
fund me.
I would establish residency in Florida and vote for Rubio then if that happened.
Yeah.
I'd like, you go, boy. You will absolutely win the next election.
I did not understand why he didn't have any security just pushing people back from him, because he was in a little press scrum, but Jones was like pushing up against him in a way that I would think that
you've been in the Capitol.
Senator would have
security. You've been in the Capitol. These guys walk around without security.
I think they should. I mean, really, if you have a press lanyard, I think you should be able to stick your microphone right under the nose of anybody you want.
There ought to be some velvet rope that you can get behind.
Really?
Even at
the Senate?
I would think so. I mean, I think they should. Yes, I do. I think there should be some barrier between the reporters, and so that you don't have situations like yesterday, because Alex Jones had press credentials. Really?
That is kind of amazing. Maybe he was there maybe he was there as a citizen watching hearings that he's interested in, but that shouldn't get him behind the scenes then, right up next to Marco Rubio. Let's do our recommendations. Scott, I'll ask you to go first. Things we're eating, drinking, watching, or listening to that we think you might enjoy.
I just came back from a lovely week in San Pedro, California, which is the harbor area of Los Angeles. Conquer the Bridge run, which is over the Vincent Thomas Bridge, which is the same architect who did the Golden Gate Bridge. And if you go to LA, everyone does the Hollywood, they go to Venice Beach, they do all that stuff. San Pedro I recommend it very highly. They have great restaurants. It's a great ethnic, blue-collar kind of town. It's quirky, it's artsy, it's really still remains a remarkable place. It's where my wife is from. So San Pedro, and everyone, San Pedro ethnically breaks down a third Mexican, a third Slav, and a third Italian. And even our Mexican friends say Pedro, so we know that you know where it is and that you're
saying
from Pedro Town. Yes,
yeah,
so
okay.
San Pedro, California.
So we need to go there? We need to visit there?
Absolutely. Go on YouTube and check out the videos and stuff. And the Conquer the Bridge run was a blast.
I have been remiss in not watching a documentary called All the Queen's Horses by Kelly Richmond Pope. She's the director. I think she's a professor at DePaul. And what this documentary from it tells the story of is Rita Crundwell, who was the comptroller of this small town, Dixon, Illinois, where Ronald Reagan is from, population about 16,000 people. Over the course of about, I think it was like 6 or 7 years, she embezzled $53 million from this little town and used it to do, among other things, to buy, you know, very, very expensive horses and to fund this extremely lavish lifestyle. And this documentary shows, teaches you about this town and how her fraud was discovered, how she pulled it off, and what happened afterwards. And it's, you know, it's pretty relevant for people who live around here. Dixon is not too far away. It's an Illinois story, very well told, very well reported, and it's on Netflix. So.
City Council got in trouble for that, too. The people would show up at meetings and go, okay, she was a crook, but wasn't your job to make sure she was ripping
off? They explain how that happened, and yeah, and they paid the price. They were ousted. Again, it's called All the Queen's Horses. I really recommend it.
And it's not a crime without victims. I mean, you said, all right, so the late two, but then potholes didn't get filled. Police officers didn't get hired or lost their jobs. So the trickle down for a small town, $50 million plus lost, is immeasurable. She is such a dark soul. She's a fascinating character.
Yes, complete.
I've seen the video.
Complete sociopath.
It's a good story. Yeah,
obviously.
Exactly. That's the word.
Have you guys ever been to Dixon?
I have not. No.
It is a charming, cute, quaint town on a river. Yeah, Janine and I, when we first moved here, took a road trip on a weekend and ended up there. And it was, and this is before
so
the story.
So you recommend that? You recommend that too? San Pedro and Dixon?
Yes, yes.
Well,
add those
them
to
out.
Your bucket list.
Actually, they did some clawback, right? Though, Eric, didn't they recover a surprisingly amount of funds?
They did.
They didn't come close to the $52 million, though, did they?
They didn't get, I think they got $35 million in the legal
like that,
zone,
yeah.
But they didn't get all that because the attorneys got their, you know, their hunk of that, and they got some back from selling her stuff, and they, you know, they auctioned off the horses, and they auctioned off her the motor coach she bought,
and the Rita jewelry.
And
so there's all kinds of stuff, but no, I think it ended up costing, I think they said something like $3,000 per resident of Dixon. It ended up her fraud ended up costing them that, and it also she broadens the lens a little bit to look at how fraud is committed and how this is a problem that is not just in Dixon but in other places around the country and around the world, where when you have people who are in charge of getting the money and writing the checks, that the temptation clearly proves to be quite strong.
Yeah, it's a great piece, and it would have been terrible if it had happened in a big city like Chicago, but just think what $53 million means to Dixon, Illinois. I'm sort of walking back or tempering a recommendation. I think I told you guys about Ozark, Jason Bateman series, that the second season just dropped over Labor Day weekend, and we just finished it last night, and it's fine. It's one of those series that I really loved, and I think I recommended on this, but
yeah,
I just
did.
Want to come back and say, okay, but if here's my problem with series like this. It's evil, stupid people continually doing evil, stupid things, and you don't have at the end of the series anybody you're rooting for, and it gets so crazy that even by crazy standards, it begs credulity.
Oh,
and
that's
so
too bad.
So about episode 8, I'm like, one of them I didn't even finish. And then I picked it up on 9 or whatever it was, because I thought, this is too bizarre even for its own good. I don't know if you feel the same way as I do, but Ozark needs to be watched with that filter.
We watched the first season with the in-laws. Started watching it over the last week, and you were right. The first season is terrific.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to feel it comes unraveling.
Well, maybe you won't feel the way I do, but I just felt the need to temper my recommendation of Ozark. And that's this week's podcast. Thank you, Eric Zorn, Scott Stanis, Steve Bertrand. You know, we sometimes are joined by Kristen McQuarrie over at the Tribune, and also Patty Vasquez and Justin Kaufman. The Mincing Rascals are produced by LF Garris, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.